This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Above the Bay of Angels, a novel written by Rhys Bowen, performed by Gemma Dawson.
Chapter 1. London, September 1896. If Helen Barton hadn't stepped out in front of an omnibus, I might still be sweeping floors and lighting fires at an ostentatious house in St. John's Wood. But for once, I had followed my father's advice. Carpe diem was one of my father's favourite sayings. Seize the day. Take your chances. He usually added, because that might be the only chance you get. He spoke from experience. He was an educated man from a good family and had known better times. As the son of a second son, he could expect to inherit neither a title nor the property that would have come with it, and was sent out to India to make something of himself, becoming an officer in the Bengal Lancers. He had married my mother, a sweet and delicate creature he met on one of his visits home. It was soon clear that she couldn't endure the harsh conditions of Bengal, so Daddy had been forced to resign his commission and return to live in England. From what Daddy told us, it had been made evident to him as a young man that he could expect no financial help from his uncle, the Earl. He never told us why, or what rift had occurred within his family, but he was clearly bitter about it. However, he had finally fallen on his feet in a way and had acquired what was considered a prestigious position. He was in charge of guest relations at the Savoy, London's new luxury hotel. His ability to speak good French and mingle with crowned heads had made him popular at the hotel. He had patted the hands of elderly Russian countesses and arranged roulette parties for dashing European princes, for which he received generous tips. We had lived quite happily in the small town of Hampstead on the northern fringes of London. My younger sister Louisa and I attended a private school. We had a woman who came to clean and cook for us. It was not an extravagant life, but a pleasant one. Until it all came crashing down when the demon drink overcame my father. He worked at an establishment where the alcohol flowed freely amongst the guests. When invited, he took a glass, as it would have been rude to refuse, so who would notice if he later finished off a bottle? I remember the first time he came home drunk.
"Roddy, where have you been?" my mother asked him when he arrived home at 10 o'clock. "We waited dinner for you. I was worried."
"None of your business, woman," he spat out the words.
My mother winced as if he had struck her. My little sister grabbed my hand. We had never seen our father like this. He was normally so amiable and adored my mother.
"Roddy, have you been drinking?" Mummy said coldly.
"Just being sociable with the clients. Part of the job, don't you know?" he said. Then he added, his voice rising aggressively, "I have to work for my living, or have you forgotten that? After all, it was because of you that I had to give up my commission in India and take a menial job, bowing and scraping to those who should be my equals. Now where's my dinner?"
I saw my mother's horrified stare as she blinked back tears. After that day, nothing was the same. It felt as if we were walking on eggshells. We never knew when he'd come home or what kind of mood he'd be in. Sometimes he was as jovial and affectionate as ever, but other times it was as if he'd turned into a monster I didn't recognize. Louisa and I spent a lot of time hiding away in our bedroom. Mummy tried hard at first, begging him to stop drinking and think of his family, but nothing she said reached him. And in the end she just seemed to give up and fade like a wilting flower. She had never been strong to begin with. I suppose we had all been dreading what happened next. My father arrived home in the middle of the afternoon, announcing that he had been dismissed from his job.
all because of some stupid Russian woman who said she'd seen my helping myself to a little sip from a bottle of scotch. They took her word against mine. Can you believe it? Who'd want to work at a place like that? I'm well rid of it.
But Roddy, what will we do? My mother asked. How will we pay the rent?
I'll find something else, don't you worry, he said breezily. A chap like me, I'll be snapped up in no time at all.
But he wasn't. He tried in vain to find another position, but without a reference, no respectable establishment wanted him. We watched him sink lower and lower into depression and drunkenness. We gave up our servant. I tried to be grown up and take over the housework, as Mummy seemed to have no energy for even the most basic of tasks. Daddy seemed genuinely concerned for her, but it didn't stop his visits to the public house. It was a bitter winter that year, and the price of coal had gone up. We spent our evenings around the kitchen table where the stove provided warmth. Mummy developed a nasty cough. I thought she should see a doctor, but Daddy dismissed the idea.
It's just a bad cold, Bella. Your mother always likes to dramatize things, you know that.
It might have started as a cold, but it turned into pneumonia, and 3 days later, she was dead. I couldn't believe she was gone. Neither could my father.
My precious darling Winnie, he said. It's all my fault. It's all my fault.
And he actually wept. He and Louisa and I hugged each other while the tears flowed. My mother was a genteel and sweet person who adored my father. They said she died of pneumonia, but I think it was of a broken heart. We moved to a squalid two-room flat above a butcher's shop, with only cold water and an outside lavatory. Father occasionally picked up work writing letters for the illiterate, tutoring in French, but nothing kept the wolf far from the door. I suppose I had no idea how bad our situation really was until one day, just before my 15th birthday, he announced he had found a position for me. I was to leave the school that I adored and became a servant in a big house, so that I'd earn money to feed Father and Louisa, and someone else would have to feed and clothe me. I was more than shocked. I was mortified. We might not have been rich, but I was from a good family.
A servant? You want me to be a servant?
I could hardly stammer the words.
I feel as terrible about it as you do, my darling child, he said. But the truth is that I can't afford to feed you. We'll be out on the street if someone doesn't pay the rent, and I can't seem to find a position. So your sister and I are relying on you at this moment.
I wanted to shout at him, to tell him that we might have enough money to scrape by if he didn't visit the public house so frequently, but I'd been brought up to be the good child, to obey my parents. I was doubly shocked when I found out that the house where I would be sent to work belonged to a nouveau riche man who had made money in the garment business. His factories turned out cheap blouses for working girls. He and his wife were loud-mouthed and commonly ostentatious. I stood outside, staring up at the gables and turrets of an incredibly ugly house.
Daddy, please don't make me do this, I pleaded. Not a servant to these people. I realize I must leave school, but there must be something else I can do.
It's only for a short while, Bella, he said, patting my hand. I promise you, as soon as I'm on my feet again, I'll bring you home. Until then, you are helping to make sure that your little sister does not starve.
What could I say to that? I realized then that he had always been a great manipulator, using his charm to get my mother to agree with whatever scheme he had in mind at that moment. So I went to work for Mr. and Mrs. Tilly at the ugly house in St. John's Wood. They kept a butler, a parlour maid, a footman, two housemaids, a cook, and a scullery maid. As the lowest housemaid, I was responsible for rising at 5 in the morning, lighting the copper in the stove, then carrying heavy scuttles of coal to the bedrooms to make sure that the family awoke to warmth. It was back-breaking, soul-destroying work. I had to share a bed with Poppy, the scullery maid, in a freezing attic room. Mercifully, I was so tired that I fell asleep instantly every night. It felt like a nightmare from which I couldn't wake up. Then one day, Mrs. Tilly was entertaining. She liked to entertain frequently. Coffee mornings and tea parties and extravagant dinners. All of these events meant extra work for us servants. We went through a frenzy of polishing silverware, making sure there wasn't a speck of dust on the mahogany table that seated 30 and, in my case, ensuring that the fires were supplied with enough coal to keep them burning brightly. On this occasion, it was a tea party. Cook had been baking all morning, scones and sponge cakes and shortbreads, so that the kitchen was full of wonderful aromas. And all afternoon she had been making little tea sandwiches, cucumber, egg and cress, smoked salmon. After Elsie, the parlourmaid, had gone up to the drawing room with the tea things, cook noticed that she had forgotten to put the macaroons onto the tray. She thrust them into my hands.
"Quick, take them up before Mrs. T notices or there will be hell to pay," she said.
I ran out of the kitchen with the dish, up the stone steps and through the green baize door that separated the servants from the real world. Female voices were coming from the drawing room. I crept in. Elsie had already put the tray on the trolley and was pouring tea. I hesitated, unsure what to do next, when Mrs. Tilly spotted me.
"What do you want, girl?" she asked.
"I've brought the macaroons, Mum," I said. They weren't quite ready when Elsie carried up the tray.
She heard my refined accent and frowned.
"Are you trying to ape your betters, girl?"
Her own accent still carried an undercurrent of her East End upbringing.
"No, Mum. I've always spoken this way. My father was a gentleman."
"Then what in God's name are you doing here?"
one of the other ladies asked.
"My mother died. My father became too ill to work, and I need to support my little sister," I replied. "There are not many jobs available to a 15-year-old.
"You poor child," the woman said.
"Life can be cruel."
Then she took a cream puff from the plate and bit into it.
"You'll never believe what I heard about Sylvia," she said, her upper lip now lined with a delicate moustache of cream.
"Do tell," the ladies leaned forward, and I was instantly forgotten.
You might have thought that my lot would have improved after that moment. It did, but only slightly. I still had to get up early to light the fires, but when Mrs. Tilly was entertaining, she'd make sure I served them in the drawing room.
"Her father was an aristocrat," she'd say in a stage whisper. "Her parents died. I took her in, poor little thing."
I'd stand there like a statue, determined to keep my face a mask of stone to show them I didn't care. I wanted these self-satisfied, patronizing ladies to know that whatever they said, they could never break me. "One day," I would whisper to myself. I wasn't sure what I meant by it, only that if I could just hang on long enough, then I'd find a way to escape, and I'd make something of my life. The only good thing about the Tilly household was that Mr. and Mrs. Tilly loved to eat. They ate very well, so well that I was able to take home leftovers to Daddy and Louisa on my afternoon off every week. My father loved his food. He would have been a gourmet if we could have afforded it, and spoke fondly about banquets he had attended, as well as Indian feasts, country picnics, Christmas at the family seat. His eyes would light up when he saw my weekly offerings wrapped in a clean napkin.
"My, my," Daddy would say. "Roast pheasant. That takes me back to my childhood. I remember a banquet with the old Earl once. We'd been out shooting. I'd bagged a couple of pheasants. My God, they were good. And smoked salmon. My dear, you are a miracle worker. A lifesaver."
He'd take my hands and gaze up at me adoringly, the way he used to look at my mother. I tried to smile back at him, although I wanted to scream. I wanted to shout at him.
"Your childhood was full of banquets. Do you know what mine is like? Have you ever scrubbed floors so that your hands are raw, or lugged coal up four flights of stairs? You have no idea what you are putting me through."
but he had become so thin and pale that I couldn't say anything to hurt him. He had called me a miracle worker, a lifesaver, and I think I really believed to begin with that I could make him well again if I brought home enough good food to fatten him up. I tried to find bottles hidden around the flat and dispose of them. After a while, however, I realized it was hopeless. He was going to drink himself into the grave. I knew I had to stay where I was, enduring Mrs. Tilly until Louisa could be somehow taken care of. Mrs. Tilly boasted about having the best cook in London. "I lured her away from titled people," she used to say. "It's true what they say, you know. Money talks. I pay her much more than she was getting, and I'm told we have the best table for miles around." We also ate well in the kitchen, and I found that I had inherited my father's palate and appreciation of good food. Our cuisine at home had always been rather basic, even in the days when we had a cook, and I became fascinated with the process of creating such wonderful flavours. "Show me how you made that parsley sauce, those meringues, that oyster stew," I'd say to Mrs. Robbins, the cook. And if she had a minute to spare, she would show me. After a while, seeing my willingness as well as my obvious aptitude for cooking, she suggested to Mrs. Tilly that her old legs were not up to standing for hours anymore and that she needed an assistant cook. And she requested me. Mrs. Tilly agreed, but only if she didn't have to pay me more money and I should still be available to do my party piece whenever she entertained. And so I went to work in the kitchen. Mrs. Robbins found me a willing pupil. After lugging coal scuttles up all those stairs, it felt like heaven to be standing at a table preparing food. We had a scullery maid who did all the most menial of jobs, like chopping the onions and peeling the potatoes, but I had to do the most basic of tasks, mashing the potatoes with lots of butter and cream until there wasn't a single lump, basting the roast so that the fat was evenly crisp. I didn't mind. I loved being amongst the rich aromas. I loved the look of a well-baked pie, the satisfaction when Mrs. Robbins nodded with approval at something I had prepared, and of course, I loved the taste of what I had created. Now when I went home to Daddy and Louisa, I could say, "I roasted that pheasant. I made that apple tart." And it gave me a great rush of satisfaction to say the words. "You've a good feel for it, I'll say that for you," Mrs. Robbins told me, and after a while, she even sought my opinion. "Does this casserole need a touch more salt, do you think? Or maybe some thyme?" The part I loved the best was the baking. She showed me how to make pastry, meringues that were light as air, all sorts of delicate biscuits and rich cakes. After a year under Mrs. Robbins's tutelage, I realized that I could now start to spread my wings. I could get a job as a cook, with the money and the respect that went with it. I made the mistake of telling Mrs. Robbins of my ambition, and she told Madame, and Madame didn't want to lose me. She loved the status that her aristocratic servant gave her. "Go on, tell them all about your dad in India," she'd say when the ladies came to call. "Tell them about your great-uncle, the Earl, and that blooming great palace of a house he lives in." When she heard that I might be thinking of leaving, she called me into the drawing room and told me that if I was ungrateful enough to want to leave, she wouldn't give me a reference. She smiled as she said it, smirked actually, knowing that nobody would hire me without a reference. I was stuck, whether I liked it or not. I tried to think of ways to escape. I could go to America, maybe. They'd be impressed by my upper-class English accent and noble background, wouldn't they? I could become a cook there, or work in a high-class shop, or become a lady's companion. The only fly in that ointment was that every penny I earned went to Daddy and Louisa. I had no way to save up for my fare, and of course, I couldn't leave them. My father died the autumn I turned 20. This did not come as a great shock to me, and I have to admit I did not feel the grief a daughter should feel. I had learned to shut off all feeling the moment I became a servant. Mrs. Tilly gave me a day off to arrange for his funeral, and Louisa and I stood together at his grave. "Well, that's that, I suppose," Louisa said. "I'm rather glad it's over, aren't you?" Glad our father died? I asked. She gave an awkward smile.
I don't mean it like that. After all, he was our father, and I suppose we loved him once, but it was like holding our breath, waiting for the end to come.
Yes, it was, I agreed.
But I'm worried about you. What will happen to you now?
She was almost 17, had shown little interest in her schooling, and was recently apprenticed to a milliner. It suited her well, as she had always been the sort of girl who admired herself in the mirror and longed to be fashionable one day, while I was interested more in my books and less in a way of life I could never have.
You like your job? I inquired. And your employers?
She nodded tentatively.
They are very kind.
I inquired whether she could live in with the family who owned the shop. She actually blushed and said that wouldn't be necessary. She had been holding off until Daddy died, but she had had a proposal and was going to marry.
Marry?
I stared at her in disbelief.
But you're only a child. Nonsense. Many girls marry at 17, she said, and Billy will take good care of me. I won't have to work.
I was more than shocked when I found out that the boy she wanted to marry was Billy Harrison, the son of the butcher above whose shop we lived.
A butcher boy? Louisa, you can't marry trade. Daddy would turn in his grave.
She regarded me haughtily.
As if our father did anything for us, Bella. He did his best, I said, not believing those words.
His best hadn't been good enough. She put her hand over mine.
Billy is a good catch, Bella. His father owns 3 shops, plus a pig farm, out in Essex. He plans to hand one of the shops over to Billy. We'll live with his parents in a nice house on Highgate Hill until Billy can find us a house of our own. You can stop being a servant and come and live with us. I'm sure Billy won't mind.
I can't tell you what anguish I went through that night.
Of course I wished my sister well and wanted her to be happy. But here I was, stuck in domestic drudgery, having toiled for 5 years to support her when she had no idea of the life I lived. I'd wanted her to be educated, to have more chances than I. And now she was going to marry, and I was still a prisoner at the house of Tilly. Life seemed bitterly unfair. Then it struck me that I'd no longer be responsible for her. My wages were now my own. I'd save up and be able to buy my ticket to America. This cheered me so much that I decided to treat myself on my next day off. No more coming home with leftovers from the Tillys. I'd go up to the West End and look in the shop windows, maybe buy myself a new comb or even some rouge for my 2 pale cheeks and maybe take tea in a tea room. So I caught the Metropolitan Underground Railway to Baker Street, then the Bakerloo Underground to Oxford Circus. It was horribly hot and smoky, and I was so relieved to come up into the fresh air again. I felt a flutter of excitement when I emerged to a different world. Smartly dressed women, big, beautiful shops. I walked along Oxford Street until I came to John Lewis's wonderful department store. I gazed at all the windows with their smartly dressed mannequins and realistic country scenes. In one window there was even a motor car. A jaunt in the country was written across the backdrop. Then I reached the front entrance and took a deep breath before I went in. It looked so beautiful it was almost like stepping into a palace. I approached the cosmetics counter and let the lady apply a little rouge to my cheeks before buying a small tin. Feeling very daring, I came out again and turned down Bond Street. I paused at Fenwick's department store, then gazed in the windows of the jewellers, hat makers, leather goods merchants and china shops until I emerged onto Piccadilly. Then a really extravagant thought struck me. I remembered my father relating how he had been taken to tea at Fortnum and Mason when he was a child. I spotted the name across the street and decided that I too would have tea there, just this once. I stood at the edge of the curb, waiting for a break in the seemingly incessant stream of hansom cabs, omnibuses, delivery carts, and even occasional motor cars. Then, right behind me, I heard a scream, shouts, and a police whistle, and my life changed in that instant.
Chapter 2. I spun around to witness a horrible scene. An omnibus stood beside the curb, its horses dancing nervously. Beneath its wheels lay the body of a young woman.
"She stepped out right in front of me," the driver shouted as he climbed down to calm the horses. "We were going too fast. I had no chance to stop."
"Is there a doctor in the crowd?"
Two police constables had arrived at the scene.
"Too late for that, mate,"
a male voice said.
"I reckon she's a goner, all right."
"Poor thing," a woman beside me muttered. "I'm not surprised. Many's the time I've had to sprint for my life as one of them omnibuses comes charging at me. The traffic is getting awful these days. You're not safe to cross the road."
The omnibus driver was backing up his horses cautiously as the constables tried to move the girl. I couldn't take my eyes off her broken body. She was not much older than I. She reminded me of a rag doll I had had as a child. My sister had stuck scissors into it in a fit of temper and let the sawdust run out so that the doll lay in a crumpled heap. As I looked on with pity and horror, I saw the girl's eyes flutter open, looking around her with surprise as if she couldn't believe what had just happened to her. Without hesitation, I stepped forward and knelt beside her, putting a gentle hand on her shoulder.
"It's all right. You're going to be all right," I said gently, although I didn't think this was true. "I'll stay here with you until a doctor comes."
She tried to focus on my face.
"Palace." The word came out as a whisper I could barely detect. "Palace. Tell."
She tried to move her hand, and I saw that she had been holding an envelope in it. I took it from her.
"Don't worry, I'll tell them," I said, although I had no idea what she meant.
Clearly it had been troubling her because the worried expression left her face. She gave a little smile and a small sigh, and her eyes closed. It almost seemed that she had fallen asleep, but a big hand touched my shoulder.
"There's nothing you can do for her now, miss."
I looked up to see a constable standing behind me.
"Were you a friend?"
He helped me to my feet.
"No, I didn't know her. I just didn't want her to think she was alone. It was so awful."
"You're a kind girl. I expect she appreciated that," he said.
Several men were lifting the girl's body onto the pavement. Someone was covering her with a rug. I had no reason to stay any longer. I pushed through the crowd that had gathered, blinking back the tears that were welling in my eyes. I was still so much in a state of shock that I had crossed the street towards the park before I realized that I was holding the girl's envelope. Something in it was so important to her that it was her one concern as she lay dying. I stepped into a shop doorway, out of the stream of passers-by, and I looked down at the envelope for the first time. It bore a crest, an impressive crest, and yet the girl was clearly from the working class, judging by her clothing. Curious now, I opened it and took out the letter inside. "To Miss Helen Barton, Sowerby Hall, near Leeds, Yorkshire. From Her Majesty's Master of the Household. Dear Miss Barton, we are in receipt of your application for the position of undercook at Buckingham Palace. The references you submitted are most satisfactory. Please present yourself at the palace on September 25th for an interview, and should you prove in every way suitable, we will be happy to offer you the position." My heart was beating so fast that I couldn't breathe. My first thought was today was September 25th. My second was that she would no longer be needing the position. It would remain vacant, to be filled by someone else. I could apply in her stead and impart the news that she had met with a tragic accident, but that I was equally qualified to do the job. But then, of course, I realized that, unlike Helen Barton, I had no satisfactory references. That was when the preposterous idea came into my head. I would present myself as Helen Barton. She was from Yorkshire, after all. Nobody here would know her.
As I kept walking down Piccadilly in the direction of Buckingham Palace, the enormity of what I was proposing threatened to overwhelm me. Did I dare to do this? And I heard my father's voice. Carpe diem, Isabella. It was indeed my one chance to escape from my present drudgery, and I couldn't let it slip away. And it was almost as if Helen Barton had wanted me to have it. She had begged me to take the envelope. Was this my one gift from heaven, to make up for all that I had suffered? When I reached the edge of Green Park, I sat on a bench, feeling the warm September sunshine on my face, and went through the ramifications. I was not hurting anybody. I was not depriving anybody of a job. In fact, I'd be doing the palace a good turn, because they would not have to advertise again for the position. And I knew I was a good cook. I stared down at the letter in my hand, and it dawned on me that this might be the only means of identifying Helen Barton. She might have had a handbag with her, but it may not have contained her address. Without this letter, her dear ones would not know she was dead. She would be buried in a pauper's grave. I couldn't let that happen, however much I wanted the job. Stay calm, Bella, I told myself. There must be a way. I thought it through logically. I would write to Sowerby Hall and inform them that I had witnessed the tragic death of Miss Barton. I would only sign the letter, a well-wisher. At least her nearest and dearest would know where to apply for her body if they desired. However, I suspected she would not have any close relatives in Yorkshire. After all, she had been planning to move to London, and she would not have done that if she had an aging mother or a sweetheart living nearby. I told myself that she was probably an orphan, and her employer obviously knew she was applying for this position as she had provided a reference. I made up my mind. In spite of all the risks, I was going to do it. I was going to seize the day, just as my father had told me. I tucked the stray wisps of hair under my hat and realized that I now had rouge on my cheeks. That would never do. I took out my handkerchief and scrubbed at my face until, I hoped, every trace had been removed. I wished I had a looking glass in my handbag. I crossed Green Park and came out to the Mall, and there was Buckingham Palace ahead of me. My heart started racing again. If I was found to be an imposter, if I was caught trying to deceive the Queen, did that count as treason? Did they still behead people in the Tower? I hesitated, looking at that imposing facade and the tall wrought-iron gates. Did I really dare to go through with this? Then, it was almost as if I could hear my father's voice. What have you got to lose, Bella? That's right, I thought. How would they ever find out I was not Helen Barton? She was from a house in the wilds of Yorkshire and presumably knew nobody in London. The Queen required a cook, and I was good. The palace would be happy to have me. Having bucked myself up in this way, I strode out, then hesitated again as I approached those imposing gates with the sentries standing in front of their boxes. Surely a servant would not enter in such a grand manner. Even Mrs. Tilly in St. John's Wood had a servant's entrance. It must be off to one side, in a discreet place. But where? I sidled up to one of the sentries.
Excuse me, but could you direct me to the servant's entrance? I whispered. I'm here for an interview.
His gaze did not falter. He continued to stare straight ahead of him, and his mouth didn't move either, but between his lips he muttered,
Off to your left, miss. Door on the wall.
I thanked him and saw the ghost of a smile twitch at his lips. Off I went, past the front of the palace and around to the side, where a tall brick wall ran around what was presumably the palace grounds. And there in the wall was the small, almost invisible door. I opened it and was met by another guard.
Miss Barton to see the master of the household in regard to the post of undercook, I said in my most efficient-sounding voice. As I said it, an awful thought struck me. What if Helen Barton had already had her interview and was on her way home when the accident occurred?
What if the master of the household informed me that he had already conducted the interview and demanded to know who in heaven's name I was? Again, it was a risk to be taken. If she had already had her interview, why was the letter still clutched in her hand? No, she had to have been on her way to the palace. At least the guard at the side gate didn't react in any way. He escorted me down a narrow path to an ordinary-looking door in a brick wall. He rang a bell. A young man appeared. A footman, I supposed, although he was not dressed in splendid livery, but in a white shirt and black trousers. "This young lady to see the master about a job interview," the guard said. I held out the letter for him to scrutinise. "Follow me, please, miss," the footman said. At least he hadn't looked at me in surprise and commented that I was the second youngest lady to present herself for the position that afternoon, which must mean that Helen Barton had been on her way to the palace. I think I let out a little sigh of relief. Along a plain white plastered hallway and up a flight of wooden steps we went, then into a slightly larger corridor. The footman tapped on a door.
"Enter,"
came a deep voice from within.
"A Miss Barton to see you, master," the footman said.
"Send her in," said the deep voice.
My heart was racing. I took a deep breath to calm myself and stepped into the room. It was not fancy, just a big mahogany desk, bookshelves and a window looking out onto the garden. The man at the desk had impressive grey whiskers and deep frown lines on his forehead. He wore a military uniform with lots of braid and was clearly the sort who expected to be obeyed with no nonsense.
"Miss Barton,"
he held out a hand to me.
"I am Colonel Pelham Clinton, Master of Her Majesty's Household. Good of you to come."
"How do you do? It's good of you to see me, Colonel,"
I replied, reaching forward to shake his hand. The frown on his forehead deepened.
"I expected a Yorkshire accent," he said. "You are not from that county?"
"Yes, sir," I replied. "My father was an educated man who had fallen upon hard times. I was raised to speak properly."
I decided to stick to the truth as much as possible. He nodded.
"And where is your father now?"
"He died. Both my parents died when I was a child. That was why I had to go into service. I no longer have anybody."
"I see,"
he nodded again.
"You have the nice red cheeks of a girl from the countryside. I'm afraid you'll soon lose those in the smoky air of the city."
I tried not to smile as I realized that the red cheeks were a result of my scrubbing off my rouge.
"And you're younger than I expected."
"I'm told I look young for my age," I replied, wondering how old Helen Barton had been. She hadn't looked much older than I. Had the advertisement stipulated over 21? He picked up a paper from his desk.
"Your letter of reference is commendable," he said. "It seems you were prized at Lady Sowerby's."
I was wondering what reason I could come up with for wanting to leave Lady Sowerby when he went on.
"The housekeeper says you are honest, sober, and willing to learn."
"Yes, sir, I am,"
I replied, while a voice whispered that I was not being honest at this moment. I almost gave in and confessed to my deception, but he was already continuing.
"It seems that Lady Sowerby is of advanced years and is closing up her household to live with her son. Is that correct?"
"So I understand, sir," I replied.
"And what made you decide to come all the way to London?"
"There is nothing to hold me in Yorkshire. And who wouldn't want to jump at the chance to serve Her Majesty?" I said. He actually smiled.
"I think you will do well here, Miss Barton. But first I have to introduce you to our maitre de cuisine, Mr. Angelo Romano. He is most particular about who works under him, down to the lowliest scullery maid. Allow me to escort you to the kitchens."
We went down the stairs, along a tiled hallway this time, and opened a swing door onto a vast kitchen. I think I swallowed back a gasp. All along one wall, rows of gleaming copper pots hung on hooks in ascending size from one pint to several gallons. Beneath them was a row of stoves on which stew pots were bubbling, sending out an enticing aroma of herbs.
I noted that the stoves were mostly modern gas burners with a couple of old-fashioned coal-fired ranges for good measure. Around the room, scrubbed pine tables were arranged, and at each of these, cooks were at work. A whole army of cooks, it seemed, dressed all in white, some in tall hats, others in caps, and all busy chopping piles of vegetables or mixing things in bowls. Actually, as I examined them more closely, I noticed nearly all of them were male. Only a couple of older women amongst them, no other young girls. The master hesitated at the door.
"Mr. Angelo, might you be free for a moment?" he asked.
A man with a curled black moustache and a most superior expression came over to us. He wore an immaculate uniform and a toque on his head. From the way he walked, I could tell he thought a lot of himself.
"What is it, master? As you can see, we're up to our eyes at the moment."
I had expected an Italian accent, but he sounded like any other Londoner.
"This young lady has applied to be an undercook," the master said. "Her references seem satisfactory, and she has a pleasant manner, but of course the final say is up to you."
Black Moustache was looking me up and down as if I were an unsavory piece of meat.
"You know my feelings about having a young woman in the kitchen."
"I do, but we also know Her Majesty's sentiments, don't we? And it is not up to us to dispute the wishes of our employer."
Black Moustache hadn't taken his eyes off me for a second.
"So, what cooking experience do you have, young woman?" he asked.
"Only plain English cooking, sir," I replied. "And of course I've only been allowed to assist, not compose the dishes myself. But I am familiar with most cooking methods."
"You have experience with game? Her Majesty is most fond of game."
"I've worked with pheasant, sir, and squab."
"And sauces?"
"I can make a smooth white sauce, sir, and a brown sauce."
"White sauce?"
He was looking down his nose at me.
"To what kind of white sauce are you referring? Velouté, bechamel, supreme, pascaline, ravigotte?"
"I'm afraid that I am not familiar with foreign terms. The cook who taught me was adamant that English food was as good as any, and she wasn't going to cook any foreign muck, as she called it." As I said the words, I wished I could unsay them. Angelo was obviously an Italian name, although I detected no trace of an accent in his speech. Actually, I thought I detected a hint of Cockney, and there was certainly a smile at the corner of his lips.
"I think I might be inclined to agree with you. Nothing is superior to a first-class joint of roast beef and Yorkshire pudding, but Her Majesty likes her food to be fancy. Not necessarily foreign, but pleasing and tantalising to the eye as well as good to taste. Some of our dishes take all day to prepare."
He paused and sucked through his teeth for a long moment before he asked,
"What would you say was your forte?"
"I'm told I have a light hand with pastry, sir."
"We have Mr. Roland, who is our pastry chef and takes care of the items for the Queen's tea and any pastry items on the pudding menu. Her Majesty is very fond of her tea and the cakes and scones that go with it. Never misses her tea, no matter where she is or what she is doing. But you may be called upon to make a meat pie for the servants' dining room."
"Oh yes, sir. I can make a good meat pie."
"That remains to be seen," he said. "But I can tell you're willing and eager to learn, and you've a nice manner to you. So I think we'll give you a trial. When can you start?"
"Since my employer is closing down her household, I could start as early as next week, if that's convenient, sir."
"Splendid," he said. "You understand that this will not be glamorous work, don't you? Occasionally, we have to cater for state banquets, and then it's fancy food and all hands on deck. But most of the time, you'll be chopping vegetables and preparing meals for the staff. And you will be at the bottom rung of our ladder here. You will take orders from me and from the other cooks who are older and wiser than you."
"I understand that, sir." He gave me a brief smile and a nod.
"I'll hand her back to you, master. I have 6 pheasants waiting to be boned."
I followed the master of the household back to his office.
"Mr. Angelo is a firm taskmaster, you will find," He expects hard work and perfection all the time.
He turned back to address me.
But you could not learn more from any chef in the country.
He is from Italy, I asked. He doesn't seem to have a foreign accent.
No, as English as you or I. London-born and bred. His ancestors came from that country several generations ago. Her Majesty selected him because she had previously had another chef with an Italian last name, of whom she was very fond, and that has given her the impression that all Italians are good cooks.
He opened the door to his office and ushered me inside, waiting until he had taken up position at his desk before addressing me again.
Your starting wage will be 15 shillings a week, all found, he said. You will be provided with your uniform and laundry service, as well as your board and lodging.
He looked up, waiting for me to say something. Thank you, sir. That sounds most satisfactory, I said, although, in truth, it wasn't much more than I had been making at Mrs. Tilly's. But the thought struck me that at least the money would now be my own. Not going to my father and sister, I'd be able to save for my future with precious little to spend it on.
And you will be required to sign documents of confidentiality, Miss Barton. Nothing that happens inside these walls is to be discussed with anyone, not even your closest friends. Nothing is to be removed from the palace, not even extra food. Is that clear?
I nodded. Yes, Master.
And walking out with a young man is frowned upon.
I have no young man, sir, I said, but I couldn't help noticing that there are no other young women in the kitchen.
That is correct. Until recently, Her Majesty's kitchen was nearly exclusively composed of male chefs, but Her Majesty is also forward-thinking. She feels that, with the new century approaching, we should create more opportunities for young women, since she herself has proved what a young woman can achieve given the chance.
I wanted to say that not many of us have the chance to inherit a monarchy, but stayed wisely silent. He went on.
I have to confess that I do not share her enthusiasm. In my experience, it is a waste of training to take on young women as they have a habit of going off and getting married.
I have no intention of doing that for a long while, sir. I am passionate about becoming a better cook. He actually nodded with approval.
Splendid. I can see we chose well. Then if you'll just sign here.
He produced a document, a pen, and inkwell. I dipped, prayed it wouldn't blot, and hesitated before I remembered to sign Helen Barton. Then he held out his hand.
Welcome to Her Majesty's service, Miss Barton.
Chapter 3. I came out of there in a daze. I started to walk across St. James's Park. Faster and faster I walked, while my mind tried to come to terms with what had just happened. I had been raised by my mother to be truthful and to always behave in a way that brought credit to my family. And yet, I had just obtained a position by lying. Could I live with myself? Then I was reminded that my family hadn't exactly done much for me. My father had sold me into near slavery, humiliated me in the worst possible way. My sister would not make use of the precious education she had been given, thanks to my back-breaking work. I owed nothing to nobody. I was a free woman, taking my life into my own hands for the first time. I was now an undercook at Buckingham Palace. My future looked bright. I'd worked hard, and maybe after a year or so, I'd have enough saved up to go to America, where I would be hired immediately as someone who had cooked for royalty. Or I'd even open my own restaurant one day. The possibilities seemed endless. Perhaps I really had been born with my father's optimism after all. It was just that those 4 years with Mrs. Tilly had almost crushed it. As soon as I reached Mrs. Tilly's house, I rushed up to my room, took out my writing paper, pen and inkwell, and began to write the letter to Sowerby Hall. I had composed it many times in my mind on the underground journey home. To whom it may concern, I am sorry to inform you that I witnessed a tragic accident in London this afternoon. a young woman was struck and killed by a speeding omnibus. I helped to gather her possessions from the street and found an envelope addressed to a Miss Helen Barton. So I can only conclude that this is the woman's name. I thought I should write to you in case the London police do not see fit to inform you of her death, and she has any next of kin who would want to know of her fate. Then I added, I have also informed the master of the household at Buckingham Palace of her tragic death. That should surely stop anyone in Yorkshire from having a need to contact the palace. I signed it, a well-wisher. I put it into an envelope, licked it shut, and went out again, straight to the nearest pillar box where I posted it. I was still feeling most unsettled when I came back, and could hardly eat a morsel of the delicious rabbit pie that cook had prepared.
Stuffed yourself with tea at a cafe, I've no doubt,
cook commented, and I didn't refute this. I went up to my room as soon as I had helped clear away supper and stood, staring out of my attic window at the skyline of chimney pots. I still couldn't quite believe what I had done. All I knew was that I would finally be able to escape. It was with great satisfaction that I presented myself to Mrs. Tilly the next morning and told her that I would be leaving at the end of the week. Her plucked eyebrows rose in astonishment.
Going? Walking out on me after all I've done for you?
That's right. I didn't say, yes, ma'am.
But where do you think you're going? What person of quality would take you on without a reference, I'd like to know?
I would love to have told her that I'd be working at the palace. I so wanted to tell her that, but I knew that the spiteful old witch would be likely to write to the palace with false complaints about me, so I had to come up with a perfect excuse on the underground ride home. I won't need to work any longer, I said. My sister is about to marry well, and I've been invited to go and live with her husband's family. This was partly true. Louisa had invited me to live with them. The offer was still open. It's just that I had declined it. Maybe the second falsehood is not as hard as the first. I saw Mrs. Tilly blink a couple of times. Then she said,
Well, lucky for some, isn't it? And since you've fallen on your feet, I don't suppose you'll be needing your last pay packet, will you?
I most certainly will expect to be paid money I've earned, I said. And I'm sure my sister's husband will want to make sure that I get what's due to me. His family is not without influence, you know. Those piggy little eyes blinked rapidly again. She got up and strode over to her purse.
Take it and get out, ungrateful girl, she said, and flung the coins at me.
I wanted to be dignified enough not to pick them up, but I bent and retrieved them before making my exit. I found that I was shaking and had to have a glass of water in the kitchen. I couldn't wait for the end of the week. My next task was to meet with my sister. She wanted to close up the flat, dispose of the contents, and move in with her future in-laws. We stood together in that damp and depressing living room while slanted evening sunlight shone on the threadbare rug through grimy windows.
Oh, Sissy, I feel so badly for you, she said. I will be leading a life of happiness and luxury while you are still slaving away for that monster. Will you not change your mind and come to live with us?
She took my hand.
You could resume your studies. You always were the bright one. You know how much the teachers thought of you.
I have to confess I had been tempted when she had brought this up before, but I wasn't about to be beholden to anyone, and I had come to realize I had a passion for cooking. So I had to invent another lie, only a half-truth this time.
You are very sweet, I said, but I've managed to find a better job, away from that awful household. You have? That's good news. Where is it?
I can't tell you where it is yet.
You can't tell me where it is?
Her sweet face clouded over.
Bella, is it somewhere shady? You are not becoming a dance hall girl, are you? Or even worse?
I had to laugh at the thought of me becoming a lady of the night.
No, it's quite respectable, I promise you. Then why can't you tell me?
I frowned. Should I just lie to her and say that I was going abroad? But then I'd never see her again and she was the only family I had.
I'd have to think this one out and come up with a way I could explain that I was now Helen Barton. We haven't quite sorted out the details of my position yet, I said. She squeezed my hands.
You won't go too far away, will you? I'll miss you so much. You are my only relative in the world.
Don't worry. I will come to visit you on my days off. I smiled at the worried frown on her face and realized that perhaps she might be having some reservations about marrying and moving in with a strange family.
And when you have children, I'll be an adoring aunt.
The worried look deepened.
I'm not so sure about that side of things.
Her voice dropped to a whisper.
One hears such awful rumours. I have let Billy kiss me, and that was actually rather nice, but beyond that...
I know little more than you, I'm afraid, I confessed. But I'm sure you'll come to enjoy it with someone you love. Mother and father were in love all their lives until he broke her heart, weren't they?
But what about childbirth?
She was still whispering, even though we were alone.
Women die all the time, don't they?
You're a strong and healthy girl, Louisa, I said, and you are marrying a rich man who can afford the best doctors. She gave me a hopeful little smile.
I hope you find someone who will love you soon, Sissy. I want so much for you to be happy.
That would be nice, I said, but in the meantime, I'm going to enjoy the challenges of my new position.
Is it far from London? You said you'll be able to visit.
Don't worry, I'll be close by, and I'll let you know as soon as I have an address you can write to. Fortunately, she dropped the subject, and we went around the flat, Louisa deciding if she wanted to take my father's few remaining good pieces of furniture with her. There was an inlaid writing desk he had made in India for my mother and refused to part with. I told Louisa to take it. The rest of the items would be sold.
Please keep all the money. I shall be well provided for, she said.
I shook my head.
No, you take the money for your wedding dress. We do not need to be beholden to Billy's family for everything. I shall be earning a good wage.
A smile flashed across her face, making me realize how very young she still was.
All right, I was worrying a little about my dress. And we shall choose yours as my maid of honour. Peacock blue, don't you think? It would look so startling with your red hair.
We held hands and gazed at each other, both realising that nothing in our lives would ever be the same again. Before we parted, I was formally introduced to her intended, a pleasant enough young man I had seen coming and going from his father's shop, and clearly smitten with my sister. But of a manner and speech that my parents would not have considered suitable as a prospect for a son-in-law. On the way home, I tried to examine my feelings. How could I afford this snobbish judgment of my sister's future husband when I was a servant? I was lower down the social scale than he, and yet my father had ingrained into us the belief that we belonged in the rarefied air of aristocrats. Would I have to accept that a lower-class husband was my lot someday? Louisa didn't seem to notice his London accent or lack of vocabulary, and she was happy. That was all that mattered, I told myself firmly. On Saturday morning, a man came with a cart to take away the last remnants of my former home. They were sold, and on Monday morning I moved into the palace. That sounds like a very grand thing to say. The reality was not quite as glamorous as this sounds. I was assigned a room of my own on the top floor, quite Spartan, decidedly chilly, with a narrow iron-framed bed, a white-painted chest of drawers with a mirror over it and two hooks on the wall to hang up clothes, but at least I would have some privacy. I was fitted for my all-white uniform, a blouse and skirt with a big apron to cover me, and a pillbox hat under which all my hair had to be hidden. I was told firmly that the apron was to be changed the moment there was any stain on it. I was always to look immaculate in case Her Majesty or one of her higher officials chose to pay a visit to the kitchens. I stood looking at myself in the mirror, a ghost-like apparition in my white uniform, and gave myself a brave little smile.
It's going to be all right, I said to myself. I'm Helen Barton, and I'm a jolly good cook.
Ah, the new girl's here,
Mr. Angelo looked up as I entered the kitchen.
Good news, as we've just had a luncheon sprung on us. Her Majesty's daughter, Princess Helena, and her granddaughter, Princess Thora, are visiting. Here's the menu. Consommé aux fines herbes, cheese croutons, poached fillet of sole with parsley sauce, and potatoes à la crème, puree of squab à la chasseur, creamed celery, pork chops with apples, red cabbage, and duchess potatoes, iced pudding à la Prince Albert, canary pudding with vanilla sauce, anchovy toast. Mr. Francis, you'll take the fish course. Mr. Roland, the puddings. I'll handle the squab and pork chops. And Mrs. Sims, you'll be on the consommé. I'll add the new girl to your team for now. What was your name again, my dear?
It's Helen, sir. My heart was thumping. I'd almost committed my first faux pas.
Well, Helen, you call me cook, not sir. I am officially maitre de cuisine, but that's a mouthful, isn't it? Simple cook will suffice. Everyone else you address as cook, apart from those apprentices. Is that clear?
Yes, cook.
He nodded. Off you go. Table by the window, and chop chop, everybody. We don't have that much time.
I went to the station I was assigned. You can cut the veg, Mrs. Sims said. She was a round, comfortable-looking woman who didn't look nearly as fearsome as the men in the kitchen, who all had a most superior look to them and seemed to be regarding me with displeasure, if not outright loathing.
Make sure you peel them well. No scraps of skin left on those carrots.
She pointed to several baskets of various vegetables.
How many do we need?
I asked.
Enough to serve 8, she replied. They're only for garnish and the soup, and Her Majesty isn't that keen on her clear soups anyway, so it will probably all come back.
I took a deep breath and selected some carrots, a turnip, a bunch of parsley. I checked the other baskets.
I don't see any onions, I said.
Mrs. Sims frowned.
Her Majesty does not use anything that could make her breath smell, she said. No onions, no garlic, no foreign spices.
I see.
I went to work, peeling the carrots, then started to chop them.
Don't do that,
a voice whispered in my ear. I turned to see a tall, lanky boy with hair even brighter red than my own standing right beside me. He had the sharp features and cheeky expression of a typical Cockney.
We always julienne the veg for soups.
Oh, thank you. I gave him a tentative smile. I wasn't really sure what julienne meant. Mrs. Tilly's cook never used foreign terms. The boy must have seen my hesitation because he took a carrot and sliced it longways into tiny, even slivers.
This is how they like it here.
The smile was truly grateful this time. I nodded and got to work.
I'm Nelson, he said. Nelson Biggs.
He paused, all the while still cutting slices of bread into cubes.
Did you say your name was Helen?
I nodded, wondering how I could ask them to call me Bella instead.
Welcome to the kitchen then, Helen. You'll find Mr. Angelo runs a tight ship here. Ever so picky he is, and quite temperamental too.
He had lowered his voice for this last phrase.
But on the whole, the work's not too demanding. Unless we have a big steak banquet, then it's crazy. And we eat well, let me tell you that.
This skinny body is not a result of undernourishment.
And he grinned.
This certainly is a large amount of food for luncheon, I said. All these courses. Does Her Majesty not take a proper dinner? Is this her main meal?
On the contrary, he replied. The dinner is even more courses. Her Majesty likes to eat, you'll soon notice that. And if you actually catch a glimpse of her one day, then you'll see where all that food goes.
Enough of your comments, young man, came Mrs. Sims' voice from the other side of the table. It's not up to you to judge what Her Majesty does or doesn't do. If she likes her food, I say good health to her. There's precious little else left in her life to give her pleasure. She wagged a chubby finger at us. Now, more work and less talk over there, or we'll be running behind, and you're setting our new girl a bad example.
Nelson winked at me as we went back to work. It felt so much better to have an ally, and by the end of the morning, Mrs. Sims had found nothing to complain about in my work. In fact, she said,
I'm sure you're going to do just fine here, my girl. I feel rather strange amongst so many men, I whispered to her. Did you also start here as a young woman?
Oh, no, dearie, she said. I only came here a few years ago. Her Majesty was visiting Lady Malmesbury, where I was cook, and she expressed great satisfaction with the food that was served. Of course, Lady Malmesbury had no alternative but to offer my services to the Queen, who readily accepted. Although, funnily enough, when I got here, I was relegated to working under the men and only allowed to do the simpler of the dishes.
Do you miss your former place of employment? I asked.
I do sometimes. I'm a country girl, like you, and I feel hemmed in the big city, but the likes of us don't have much say over what happens, do we?
I have to admit it's a pleasant enough atmosphere most of the time, and the work's not too hard, although I must say it's nice having a young woman to chat with.
The men keep to themselves, and Mrs. Gillespie's not exactly a little ray of sunshine.
I glanced over at a far table where the grim-faced woman was chopping celery sticks with the violence of an executioner. As I was taking off my apron, Mr. Angelo came up to me.
If you want to know what it takes to become a proper cook in this establishment, I suggest you study some of our cookery books on the shelf during your spare time. You can start with the one written by my fellow countryman, Charles Francatelli. He was chef to the Queen and Prince Albert and invented many of the dishes that have become her favourite. Take it and start making notes. You can begin with your white sauces.
Yes, cook, I murmured, and went to retrieve the heavy tome from the shelf. After our supper, I sat under the electric light in our common room and started to read. Oh, heavens above! I had thought, in my ignorance, that I had become quite a fair cook. Now I realised how much I had to learn. I thumbed through page after page, over 1,400 recipes, many involving things I had never heard of, and so complex, so complicated. Page after page of sauces, page after page of soups. Bisque of snipe à la bonne bouche, bisque of crab à la Fitzhardinge, which included adding a pint of boiling cream. Puree of asparagus à la St. George involved 3 dozen small quenelles of fowl and 1/2 pint of small fillets of red tongue. Mercy me. I flicked on. What on earth was ragout of cock's kernels à la soubise or ragout of ox palates? At the Tillys' residence, we rarely ate offal. Mr. Tilly was fond of liver and bacon, but Mrs. Tilly saw offal as food of the lower classes, for those who could afford nothing better. So our meals were good old-fashioned roast beef, leg of lamb, chops and steaks with the occasional steak and kidney pie. These recipes looked horribly complicated. Put about 1/2 pound of cock's kernels with cold water into a stewpan, let it stand by the side of a slow fire to remove the little blood they contain.